At that point, he was so tired, hungry, and thirsty, he didn't care. He figured he would find a town, get directions, and rest for a while. He flew along the coast until sunrise, when he spotted the towers of a city in the distance. "Hooray," he said to himself. "Cities mean people. I like people." As he flew closer, he saw that something weird was going on. Several thousand people had gathered along the docks of the harbor. They were staring at the water as if they were waiting for something. Toward the back of the crowd, a silk pavilion was set up where it looked like the king and queen of the city were observing whatever was going on. At the entrance to the harbor, a single spire of jagged rock jutted up from the sea. On a tiny ledge about 40 feet above the waves, chained to the rock, was a teenage girl. "This is not normal behavior," Perseus thought. He took off his cap of invisibility so as not to startle the girl. Like a dude with winged shoes flying toward you out of nowhere isn't startling, and flew down to see her. The girl acted strangely calm. She stared at him with beautiful dark eyes. Her hair was as black as ebony, her skin like polished copper. She wore only a plain green dress that showed off her lovely arms and neck. Perseus hovered next to her in the air. He tried to remember how to form a complete sentence. He was pretty sure he'd been able to do that a few moments before. "You shouldn't be here," the girl told him. "The sea monster will be here any second to kill me." "Sea monster?" Perseus snapped out of his daze. "What's going on? Why are you chained to this rock?"
"Because my parents are super lame."
"Okay, details?"
"My name is Andromeda. I'm the princess of that kingdom over there, Ethiopia."
"You mean your parents are the king and the queen?" Perseus asked. "And they let you be chained out here?"
Andromeda rolled her gorgeous eyes. "It was their idea. Long story. My mom, Queen Cassiopeia, she's totally vain. About a year ago, she started bragging that she was even more beautiful than Poseidon's Nereids."
"Oh, snap." Perseus had never met a Nereid, but he'd heard about them. They were Poseidon's troop of underwater sea goddesses, and they were supposedly stunning. He also knew that the gods hated it when humans compared themselves to immortals.
"Yeah," Andromeda agreed. "So Poseidon got angry and sent this stupid sea monster to terrorize our city. It's been sinking ships, blow-torching the harbor, chomping up the fishermen, and totally making it impossible to get a tan on the beach. So this stupid local priest or whatever, he told my dad, King Cepheus, that the only way to make Poseidon happy was to chain me to this rock as a human sacrifice."
"That's messed up," Perseus said. "It wasn't your fault."
"I tried to explain that to the townspeople. It didn't go over so well."
"You don't seem very frightened." Andromeda shrugged as best she could with her arms in chains.
"There's not much I can do about it. Besides, getting killed by a sea monster doesn't sound as bad as living with my jerk parents. If they think I'm going to scream and plead for my life, I'm not giving them the satisfaction. When that monster shows up, I plan on cussing at him so bad his little aquatic ears will bleed. I've been practicing."
Perseus thought for a moment. "I'm sure your cuss words are formidable, but what if there's another way? What if I cut you free and save you?"
"That would be cool," Andromeda said, "but it doesn't solve the sea monster problem. I mean, the townspeople were pretty horrible to me, but I don't want the sea monster to slaughter them. Besides, the monster would probably follow me wherever I lived."
"Nah," Perseus said, "because I'll kill him." Andromeda stared at him.
"No offense, you're cute, and I'm sure you're brave, but the sea monster is like, well, actually, there he is now."
Next to the spire of rock, the water boiled. The sea monster reared his dump truck-sized head. His face was covered in greenish-blue scales. Needle-sharp teeth lined his mouth. His neck arched out of the water until his yellow reptilian eyes were even with Andromeda's perch. Below sea level, the shadow of the thing's huge body looked like Nessie on steroids. The monster hissed, spewing drool and flames. He'd apparently been eating whales for appetizers because his breath was ultra rank. On the shore, the townspeople screamed and yelled. Perseus couldn't tell if they were terrified or just excited. After fighting Medusa, though, Perseus wasn't too impressed with the sea monster. "Andromeda," he said, "close your eyes."
"Okay."
"Hey, buddy," Perseus asked the monster, "you want to see what I got in the bag?" The sea monster tilted his huge head. He wasn't used to mortals talking to him so calmly. Also, he loved surprises. Perseus closed his eyes and pulled out the head of Medusa. A crackling sound ran down the length of the monster's body, like a lake flash freezing. Perseus counted to three. He stuffed Medusa's head back in the bag and opened his eyes. The monster had turned into the world's largest sand sculpture. As Perseus watched, it crumbled back into the ocean. Andromeda said.
"Can I look now?"
"Yep."
"Is it gross?"
"Nope, not really." Andromeda stared down at the huge patch of monster dust swirling in the waves.
"Wow, how did you do that?"
Perseus explained about the head of Medusa. Andromeda glanced at the bag hanging from his belt.
"Cool. So, about these chains?"
Perseus cut her free. "You want to get married or something?"
"Sounds awesome," Andromeda said.
"Can I get a hug?"
"You can absolutely get a hug."
That's when Perseus knew it was true love. They hugged and kissed. Then he grabbed her around the waist, and they flew to the city. They landed at the king and queen's pavilion. As you can imagine, a Greek warrior flying out of the sky after turning a monster to dust gets a lot of oohs and ahs. Andromeda explained what had happened and announced that she had decided to marry this handsome Greek prince.
"Unless there are any objections," Perseus added.
King Cepheus looked at the son of Zeus with his buff muscles and his winged shoes, his blood-splattered armor, and his extremely sharp-looking sword.
"No objections," the king announced.
The queen gulped like she was trying to swallow a dry scone.
"Great," Perseus said. "I want you guys to give thanks to the gods for my victory, okay? And, you know, to apologize for being boneheads. On that rock spire where you chained your daughter, I want you to build three shrines. The one on the left should be to Hermes. The one on the right will be for Athena. And the one in the middle will be for Zeus. If Poseidon gets mad about his sea monster being killed, well, those shrines should convince him this city is under the other three gods' protection. Unless he wants a war with them, he'll back off. And while you're at it, sacrifice some cows for the gods."
"Cows," the king said.
"Yeah, three should be good. Now let's have a marriage feast."
The crowd, which had been cheering for Andromeda's death a moment ago, now cheered for her marriage. The king and queen hastily arranged a party at the palace with lots of feasting and clogging and square dancing or whatever else those crazy Ethiopians did when they busted loose. Queen Cassiopeia spent most of her time admiring her reflection in Perseus's shield, because some people never learn. Unfortunately, not everyone was happy about the marriage. This local rich dude named Phineas had been promised Andromeda's hand in marriage, back before the whole sea monster problem. Now that the danger was past, Phineas got angry that his future bride had been given away to some Greek with a flashy sword and a head in a sack. During the feast, Phineas gathered 50 of his toughest friends. They drank too much wine, talked some trash, and decided they could totally take down this newcomer Perseus. They charged into the dining hall, waving weapons and making noise.
"Give me back my wife, you scum!"
Phineas threw a spear at Perseus, but since Phineas had been drinking, the spear sailed over Perseus's head. Let that be a lesson to you kids. Don't drink and throw spears. Perseus rose from the table.
"Who is this joker?"
"That's Phineas," Andromeda grumbled.
"What kind of name is Phineas? Sounds like a cartoon character."
"He's a local rich jerk," Andromeda said. "Thinks he owns me."
"Would it be okay with you if he died, like suddenly and violently?"
"I could live with my grief," said the princess.
"You heard her, Phineas," Perseus warned. "You and your friends leave while you can."
Scummy Greek! Phineas yelled. Let's get him!
Another piece of advice? Let's get him is a terrible thing to be carved on your tombstone as your last words. 50 Ethiopian warriors charged, and Perseus went to work. Did I mention that he was the best warrior in Seraphos? Well, it turned out he was the best warrior pretty much anywhere. He lopped off one guy's head, he stabbed another guy in the chest, he sliced the arms and legs off several others, and basically turned the feast into a bloodbath. Phineas bravely stayed at the back of the crowd, chucking spears and missing. Finally, Perseus got annoyed with that. He caught one of the spears and threw it back. It would have impaled Phineas, but at the last second, Phineas ducked behind a statue of Athena. The spear clinged off the goddess's stone shield.
Oh, that's low, Perseus yelled. Hiding behind my favorite goddess!
He got even angrier. He killed more guys. Ultimately, Perseus backed Phineas and his remaining friends into a corner.
Give up, he said. I'm getting tired of this, and you got blood all over my wedding outfit. We'll never surrender, cried Phineas.
His friends brandished their swords, though they didn't look quite as sure about it anymore.
Okay, whatever, Perseus said. I warned you.
He shouted so everyone in the room could hear.
Anyone who's a friend of mine, cover your eyes. I'm bringing out the head of Medusa.
The smart people all covered their eyes.
Oh, please, Phineas said. He's just trying to fool us with his lies. That sea monster was probably just a clever illusion he conjured up to make himself look tough. He doesn't really have Medusa's head in his...
Perseus brought out Medusa's head. Phineas and all his friends turned to stone. Perseus put the head back in the sack and wiped his bloody sword on the nearest curtain. He looked at his new in-laws, the king and queen.
Sorry about the mess, he said.
No problem, the king squeaked.
The queen didn't respond. She was too busy checking out her reflection in her goblet.
Andromeda, said Perseus, you ready to get out of here?
Yeah.
The princess gave her parents one last contemptuous look.
This kingdom blows.
Together, they flew off into the sunset, heading for Seraphos, after carefully checking the best route on Apple Maps. At this point, the ancient Greek and Roman writers added a bunch of side adventures for Perseus. They claimed he visited Italy and a dozen different islands, but I think they just wanted to get in on the Perseus tourism boom. Like, Perseus slept here, and get your photo taken on the spot where Perseus killed the fearsome warthog of Malta. I don't buy all that. One story even told how Perseus flew to the western edge of Africa, saw the Titan Atlas, who was holding up the sky, and turned Atlas to stone with Medusa's head. They claim that's where the Atlas Mountains in North Africa came from. I don't buy that either because, one, Medusa's head couldn't turn immortals to stone. Two, Atlas appears in a bunch of other stories later on, very much alive. And three, I've met Atlas personally. And he was definitely not a statue. Hard-headed, yes, but not a statue. Eventually, Perseus and Andromeda found their way back to the island of Seraphos. When they arrived, they got a shock even worse than a pack of gorgons. The whole city was decked out with banners and flowers. It looked like someone important was getting married, and Perseus had a sinking feeling it wasn't the king's old friend, what's-her-name. He and Andromeda swooped over the castle walls. They flew through a window straight into the throne room, where a crowd was assembled for the wedding ceremony. King Polydectes stood on his dais, dressed in white and gold, a big smile on his face as two burly guards hauled Perseus's mother, Danae, toward the throne. She struggled and screamed, but no one tried to help her except the king's brother, the fisherman Dictys, who had rescued Danae and Perseus from the sea many years before. As Perseus watched, the fisherman tried to pull off one of the guards, but the guard cuffed the old man in the face and knocked him to the floor.
Stop!
Perseus roared. He and Andromeda landed in the middle of the room. The crowd gasped and fell back. King Polydectes blanched. He couldn't believe Perseus was back, alive, now. The kid couldn't wait another 5 minutes? Also, the king didn't like the look of Perseus's new sword or the bloody leather sack tied to his belt. But since they had an audience, the king put on his brave face.
"Well, look who it is," Polydectes sneered. "The ungrateful waif who makes big promises. Why have you returned, boy? To make excuses for your failure?"
"Oh, I found Medusa."
Perseus kept his voice calm and level. He raised the leather pouch.
"Here's her head, just as I promised. Now what exactly is going on?"
"It's simple," the king said. "Your mother has finally agreed to marry me."
"No, I haven't," Danae screamed.
One of the guards covered her mouth. Some of the crowd, the same ones who had mocked Perseus when he left on his quest, laughed nervously. Andromeda slipped her hand into Perseus's.
"Time to cover my eyes, babe, because that king over there needs killing."
"Agreed," Perseus said.
"Polydectes, you will never marry my mother. You're not worthy of her, or of being king. Give up your crown, and I'll let you go into exile. Otherwise..."
"Ridiculous!" the king shrieked. "Guards, kill him!"
A dozen soldiers leveled their spears and formed a ring around Perseus and Andromeda.
"Don't do this," Perseus warned them. "I'll turn you to stone." "Yeah, right," the king yelled. "Bring it on!"
Which, again, is a terrible last statement to be carved on your tombstone.
"Anyone who is with me," Perseus yelled, "close your eyes now."
Andromeda, Danae, and Dictys closed their eyes as Perseus brought out the severed head of the Gorgon. A crackling sound spread over the room. Then there was absolute silence. Perseus put away Medusa's head. He opened his eyes. The entire crowd, except for his friends, had been turned to stone, which meant the price of marble statuary on Seraphos was going to crater. Polydectes sat on his throne, frozen mid-scream. The guards looked like oversized chess pieces. The snotty nobles who had laughed at Perseus would never laugh at anyone again.
"Well, that was awesome," Andromeda kissed her husband. "Good job."
Perseus made sure his mother was okay. She gave him a big hug. Then he pulled the old fisherman Dictys to his feet.
"Thank you, my friend," Perseus said. "You are always kind to us. You're a good man. Now that your brother is dead, I want you to be king of Seraphos."
He called out to the throne room. "Any objections?" None of the frozen nobles said anything. The fisherman looked bewildered.
"I mean, thank you, I guess. But what about you, Perseus? Shouldn't you take the throne?"
Perseus smiled. "Seraphos has never been my home. Argus is where I was born. That's where I will become the king." He left his mom in Seraphos because she had no desire to go back to her childhood home. Can you blame her? He promised to text and Skype as much as possible because he was a good son. Then he and Andromeda flew off to the Greek mainland. As it turned out, Perseus's grandfather, you remember, old Acrisius with the bronze cell and the screaming and the yelling, got advance warning of his grandson's plans. I don't know how. Maybe he had a prophecy or a bad dream. By the time Perseus got there, Acrisius had fled the city. Nobody objected as Perseus and Andromeda became the king and queen of Argus. They had a wonderful marriage and scads of children. Perseus gave his magic items back to Hermes, because you can't be greedy about stuff like that, and gifted the head of Medusa to the goddess Athena, who liked it so much she had it bronzed at the center of her shield, the Aegis, to terrify her enemies when she charged into battle. At this point, maybe you're wondering about the prophecy that started the whole story. Wasn't Perseus supposed to kill his grandfather? He did, later on, and it was a total accident. Several years after Perseus became king, he was attending these athletic games in a neighboring kingdom. A bunch of nobles were competing to show off their coolness and win sweet prizes,
Perseus signed up for the discus throw. The old King Acrisius happened to be there. He'd been hiding in the kingdom for a while, disguised as a beggar, but he made his way to the front of the crowd to watch the games, because they reminded him of the good old days when he'd been a king, not living in constant fear for his life. Perseus got ready for his turn. If you've never seen a discus, it's basically a 3-pound metal frisbee. The idea is to chuck it as far as you can to prove how strong you are. Acrisius hadn't seen his grandson since Perseus was an infant. He didn't know who the athlete was until the announcer called,
"Give it up for Perseus of Argos!"
The old man's eyes widened. He muttered, "Oh, crud." Or maybe something stronger. Before Acrisius could get away, Perseus tossed his discus. A freak gust of wind caught it and hurled it straight at Acrisius, killing him instantly. "Ouch!" the crowd yelled. Perseus felt terrible, having killed an old man like that. But once ancient Greek CSI identified the body as Acrisius and the death was ruled an accident, Perseus decided it was the will of the gods. He went back home to Argos and had more kids with Andromeda. They had such a big family that half of Greece claimed to be descended from Perseus. One of his sons, Perses, supposedly started the line of Persian kings. One of his daughters was named Gorgophone. Like, seriously, why? Doesn't that mean sounds like a Gorgon? Was she named after his emergency hotline? "Quick, King Perseus, you've got to call on the Gorgophone." His most famous descendant was a guy named Hercules. We'll get to him later. Right now, let's let Perseus enjoy his happy ending with lots of hugs from Andromeda and lots of little demigod babies. Because I want to prove that Andromeda's mom, Cassiopeia, was not the worst mother-in-law in history. That honor belongs to the love goddess Aphrodite. She made life so tough for a girl named Psyche. Well, if you've got the stomach for fighting dragons, enduring torture, taking a trip to Hades, and facing a herd of killer sheep, read on. It's not pretty. Psyche ninjas a box of beauty cream. It must suck to be born super gorgeous. No, I'm serious. Think about it. Psyche should have had a happy childhood. Her parents were the king and queen of a Greek city. She had two older sisters, so the pressure was off about how well she did in school and who she would have to marry. She should have been able to kick back, enjoy being the baby princess, and live life however she wanted. Unfortunately, she was beautiful. I'm not talking about normal human-level beauty. Her sisters were normal beautiful. If Psyche had been as attractive as them, or even slightly more attractive, that would have been okay. But as soon as Psyche became a teenager, she went from being, "That little kid is so adorable," to, "Oh my gods. Oh, wow. She is super hot." She couldn't open her bedroom window without 100 guys gathering in the street below, clamoring and applauding and throwing flowers, which really hurt if they happened to smack her in the face. Whenever she walked through town, she had to take 4 bodyguards with her to keep admirers away. She wasn't stuck up about it. She didn't feel like she was better than anyone else. She didn't want the attention. In fact, she wished she was a normal girl with normal looks, but she couldn't exactly complain to anyone about her problems. "Oh, poor you," her friends would say, their faces green with envy. "You're too gorgeous. That must be a terrible burden." The older she got, the more trouble she had keeping friends. Everyone at school started treating her cruelly. They excluded her and spread rumors about her, because that's what people do when they feel threatened. But I guess if you've ever been in any school anywhere, you already know that. Psyche's two sisters were the worst. They pretended to be nice, but behind her back, they said the meanest things and encouraged everyone else to be mean too. "Oh well," you're thinking. "At least being super gorgeous, she could have any guy she wanted, right?" Wrong.
Psyche was so beautiful, so intimidatingly awesome, no guy dared to ask her out. They admired her. They threw flowers. They sighed and gazed at her face and drew pictures of her during study hall, but they loved her the way you would love your favorite song or a fantastic movie or the best pictures on DeviantArt. She was above reality. Perfect because she was unattainable, unattainable because she was perfect. Psyche's parents kept waiting for marriage offers to roll in. None did. Her sisters, who were just regular old mortal beautiful, got married to rich husbands who were kings of other towns. But Psyche remained in her parents' palace, all alone, without friends or a boyfriend or anything. This made Psyche miserable, but it didn't stop the adoration of the crowds. By the time she was 17, the townsfolk had constructed a life-size marble statue of her in the public square. Legends started spreading that she wasn't even human. She was a goddess come down from Mount Olympus, a second Aphrodite, an even better Aphrodite. People from the surrounding kingdom started to visit, hoping to catch a glimpse of her. Her hometown got rich off Psyche-centered tourism. They made t-shirts. They offered guided tours. They sold a full line of cosmetic products guaranteed to make you look like Psyche. Psyche tried to discourage this. She was pious and smart, qualities no one ever seemed to notice since she was also beautiful. She always said her prayers and left offerings at the temples because she didn't want to upset the gods. "I'm not a goddess," she would tell people. "Stop saying that."
"Yeah," they muttered as soon as she left. "She's a goddess, all right."
Psyche's popularity went viral. Soon throngs of people from all around the Mediterranean were making pilgrimages to see her rather than going to the temples of Aphrodite. You can probably guess how that went over with Aphrodite. One day, the goddess looked down from her personal beauty spa on Mount Olympus, expecting to see hordes of adoring fans at her main temple on her sacred island of Cythera. Instead, the temple was deserted. The floor was caked with dust. The altar was empty. Even the priests were gone. A sign on the door read, "Gone to worship Psyche. BBL. "What's going on?" Aphrodite bolted upright, nearly ruining her manicure. "Where is everyone? Why is no one worshiping me? Who is Psyche?" Her servants didn't want to tell her because they'd seen the goddess get angry before, but it didn't take long for her to find out. A few minutes watching the mortal world, a couple of hashtag searches, and she knew all about the upstart Psyche. "Oh, Hades, no!" Aphrodite growled. "I am the most important and beautiful goddess in the universe, and I'm getting upstaged by a mortal girl? Eros, get in here!" According to some legends, Eros was even older than Aphrodite. According to other legends, he was Aphrodite's son. I don't know which is true, but in this story, Aphrodite definitely treats him as her son. Maybe he was, or maybe Aphrodite just thought he was, and Eros was too afraid to correct her. Either way, the dude was the god of romantic love, kind of the male counterpart to Aphrodite. He's better known by his Roman name, Cupid. Does that mean he was a chubby Valentine baby with teeny wings, a tiny bow, and cute little arrows? Not so much. Eros was devilishly handsome. All the ladies wanted his photo as their home screen. You want details? Sorry, I've got none. Like Aphrodite, he sort of appeared however you wanted him to appear. So ladies, imagine your perfect guy, and that's what Eros looked like. He sauntered into his mom's audience chamber, rocking the skinny jeans and the fashionably ripped t-shirt, his hair tousled perfectly, and his eyes gleaming with mischief, his theme song, "I'm Too Sexy," playing in the background. I'm making that up. I wasn't actually there.
"What's up?" he asked.
"What's up?" Aphrodite screeched. "Have you heard about this girl Psyche? Are you even paying attention to what's going on in the mortal world?" Eros rubbed his handsome chin.
"Psyche? No, doesn't ring a bell."
Aphrodite explained how Psyche was stealing all her followers and their offerings, as well as the headlines in the gossip magazines. Eris shuffled nervously. He didn't like it when Aphrodite got upset. She tended to destroy things with pretty pink explosions.
So, what do you want me to do about it?
Aphrodite glared at him. What do I want you to do? Your job! Your arrows cause mortals to fall in love, don't they? Find this girl and teach her a lesson. Make her fall for the most disgusting, horrible man in the world. Perhaps a smelly old beggar. Or a violent murderer. I don't care about the details. Surprise me. Be a good son. Make her regret her beauty. Of course, Psyche already regretted her beauty, but Aphrodite didn't know that. The idea would not have computed in her immortal brain. Eris flapped his feathery white wings. Oh, yeah, he had huge wings. Did I mention that?
I'm on it. Mom, don't worry.
Eris flew out of Aphrodite's day spa. He spiraled down toward the mortal world, anxious to complete his mission. He was curious to find this girl and see what the fuss was about. He absolutely adored shipping people with unlikely partners. Maybe he'd make her fall in love with a used chariot salesman or some geezer with an infectious skin disease. That would be hilarious.
Oh, yeah, Eris chuckled to himself. Psyche's going to wish she never saw me.
It turned out he was right, but not in the way he imagined. Meanwhile, down in the palace, Psyche hated her life. Her sisters were married and gone. She had no friends. She was alone with just her parents and a bunch of bodyguards. She spent most of her time in bed, with the shades drawn and the covers up over her head, weeping and heartbroken. Naturally, her parents were concerned. Also, they'd been hoping to make a good marriage for her, because that brought lots of bennies like military alliances and positive buzz in the media. They didn't understand how such a beautiful, famous daughter, the next Aphrodite, could be so miserable. The king came to visit her.
Honey, what's wrong? What can I do?
Psyche sniffled.
Just let me die.
I was thinking more along the lines of a cup of hot cocoa. Or a new teddy bear.
Daddy, I'm 17.
I tell you what. How about I go to Delphi and consult the Oracle? The god Apollo should be able to advise us.
Did I mention that going to Delphi is usually a bad idea? The king went anyway. He asked the Oracle how to get his daughter a good husband. The oracle lady inhaled some volcanic vapor and spoke in a deep male voice, the voice of Apollo.
"Despair, king,"
she bellowed, which is never the opening line you want to hear.
"Your daughter shall marry no mortal. She is destined to marry a monster, a fierce, barbaric beast even the gods fear. Dress her for her wedding as you would dress her for her funeral. Take her to the tallest spire of rock in your kingdom. There, she shall meet her doom. 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 Doom."
Echoed through the cavern. Oracle's voice returned to normal.
"Thank you for your offering. Have a nice day."
Once the king returned home, he went to see his daughter.
"Honey, I have some good news and some bad news. The good news is you're going to get a husband."
When Psyche heard the prophecy, she became still and quiet, which was scarier to her parents than the weeping. She accepted her fate. She'd asked to die, hadn't she? Apparently the gods had granted her wish. She was going to marry a monster, and she assumed "marry" was a euphemism for getting torn apart and devoured as part of the monster's balanced breakfast. Her parents wept, but Psyche took their hands. "Don't weep for me. This is what happens when mortals challenge the gods. I should have put a stop to the new Aphrodite nonsense sooner. I knew it was going to cause trouble. I'm no goddess. I'm just a girl. If my death puts things right again and spares the city from the wrath of the gods, then I'm okay with that. It'll be the first good thing I've ever done with my life." her parents felt horrible. But they'd gotten direct orders from the god Apollo, and you can't ignore Apollo unless you want to get vaporized by a rain of fiery death arrows. When news got out, the whole city went into a state of mourning. Their divinely beautiful princess, the goddess of love reborn, was going to be sacrificed to a monster on the tallest rock spire in the kingdom. This would not be good for the local psyche TM cosmetics industry. Her parents dressed Psyche in a black silk funeral gown. They covered her face with a black bridal veil and put a bouquet of black flowers in her hands. They escorted her to the edge of the kingdom, where a 500-foot spire of rock jutted into the sky. Centuries ago, narrow steps had been carved around it so it could be used as a watchtower. Psyche climbed these steps alone until she reached the top. "Here goes nothing," she thought, looking at the rocky ground far below. "I hope I get reborn with average looks. Or ugly. I would love to be ugly for a change." She felt no fear, which kind of surprised her. In fact, for the first time in years, she felt at peace. She waited for a moment to see if some monster would swoop out of nowhere and bite her in half. When that didn't happen, she decided to take matters into her own hands. She jumped. As far as her parents could tell from their vantage point behind the spire, Psyche plummeted to her death. They never found her body. But that didn't mean anything. It was a windy day, and they were too upset to launch a full-scale search. Besides, if Psyche hadn't died, that meant the monster of the prophecy had taken her, which was even worse. The king and queen returned home, broken-hearted, convinced they would never see their beloved daughter and favorite tourism magnet again. The end. Not really. In the long run, Psyche would have suffered less if she had died, but she didn't. As she fell from the rock, the winds swirled around her. 40 feet from the valley floor, they slowed her fall and lifted her up. "Hi," said a disembodied voice. "I'm Zephyrus, god of the west wind. How you doing today?"
Terrified, said Psyche.
"Great," said Zephyrus. "So we have a short flight this morning, heading over to my master's palace. Weather looks good, maybe a little turbulence on our initial ascent."
"Your master's palace?"
"Please remember to keep your seatbelt fastened, and don't disable the smoke detectors in the lavatory."
"What language are you speaking?" Psyche demanded. "What are you talking?" "Ah!"
The west wind swept her away at 1,000 miles an hour, leaving behind Psyche's stomach and a trail of black flower petals. They touched down in a grassy valley blanketed with wildflowers. Butterflies flitted through the sunlight. Rising in the distance was the most beautiful palace Psyche had ever seen.
"Thanks for flying with us today," Zephyrus said. "We know you have a lot of options when choosing a directional wind, and we appreciate your business. Now, you'd better get going. He'll be waiting."
"Who?"
But the air turned still. Psyche sensed that the wind god was gone. Nervously, she approached the sprawling white villa. Gardens and orchards surrounded the property. A clear stream wended through flower beds. Shady arbors were laden with honeysuckle. Psyche passed through the main doors into a living room with a paneled cedar and ivory ceiling, walls etched in silver geometric patterns, and a mosaic floor made of precious jewels. Comfy white couches faced a low table filled with bowls of luscious fruit, steaming fresh bread, and pitchers of ice-cold lemonade. And that was just the first room. In amazement, Psyche wandered through the palace. She found atriums with rose gardens and glittering fountains, bedrooms with the finest linens and fluffy feather pillows, libraries full of scrolls, an indoor swimming pool with a water slide, a gourmet kitchen, a bowling alley, a home theater room with overstuffed reclining seats, and a popcorn machine. This place had it all. It made her family's royal palace back home look like one of those nasty portable classroom buildings.
She opened a random closet. Stacks of gold bars gleamed inside. She opened another closet. Tupperware bins were neatly labeled diamonds, emeralds, rubies, bow ties, fezzes, and sapphires. So many riches, the contents of any broom closet in the palace would be enough to buy a private island and your own army to defend it. Who lives here? Psyche wondered aloud. Who owns all this stuff? Right next to her, a woman's voice said, "You do, mistress." Psyche jumped, knocking over a large vase that shattered and spilled diamonds all over the floor. "Who's there?" "I'm sorry to startle you, mistress," said the invisible woman. "I am one of your servants. I only spoke because you asked a question. This is your palace. Everything here belongs to you."
But I...
"Don't worry about the mess, mistress," said the servant. A gust of wind swept up the diamonds and the shards of broken vase and whisked them away.
"Anything you need, we will provide," said the servant. "I've drawn a nice hot bath for you. After that, if you're hungry, your private buffet line is open all day. If you require music, just ask. The invisible musicians know all your favorite songs. After dark, I will show you to your bedroom, and your husband will arrive."
Psyche's throat twisted like a Twizzler.
"My husband?" "Yes, mistress."
"Who is my husband?"
"The lord of this house."
"But who is the lord of this house?"
"Your husband, of course."
Psyche took a shaky breath. "We could go around in circles like this forever, couldn't we?"
"If you wish, mistress, I am here to serve."
Psyche decided a hot bath would be good, because she needed to calm down. After her soak in the tub, with a dozen choices of scented bath oils, accompanied by floating candles, 1,000-jet jacuzzi whirlpool action, and soothing music, invisible servants brought her the most beautiful, comfortable clothes she'd ever worn. She ate the best dinner of her life, while unseen musicians played her top 10 tunes, and the sun went down over the blooming apple trees in the orchard. The knot in her stomach only got tighter. Her husband would arrive after dark. The oracle had warned her parents. She was doomed to marry a monster, a barbaric beast feared by the gods themselves. But how could a monster live in a place like this? If he wanted her dead, why wasn't she dead already? By the way, if this whole thing is starting to sound like Beauty and the Beast, with the mysterious monster dude who lives in a cool palace with magic servants, that's no accident. Beauty and the Beast was totally based on Psyche's story. Just don't expect any singing teapots, because that ain't going to happen. Finally, nightfall came. Psyche could have refused to go to bed. She could have tried to run away, but she decided that would only postpone her fate. After hours of wondering and worrying, it was almost a relief when it got dark. Besides, she had to admit, she was a little bit curious. She'd never had a boyfriend, much less a husband. What if he wasn't so bad? The invisible servants guided Psyche to her bedchamber and gave her a nice warm set of My Little Pegasus pajamas, the kind with footies. She climbed into her huge bed, which was so soft it was like floating on air. She knew about that thanks to her trip with Zephyrus. A breeze swirled through the room, snuffing out the candles and lamps. In total darkness, Psyche heard the door open. Bare feet padded across the marble. Something heavy sank onto the edge of the mattress.
"Hello," said a man's voice.
He didn't sound monstrous. He sounded like a radio announcer. His tone was gentle and tinged with humor, as if he understood how ridiculous this first meeting was.
"I'm sorry for the drama," he said. "It was the only way I could arrange to meet you without certain people noticing."
Psyche found it difficult to talk because her heart was lodged in her windpipe.
Who are you?"
The man chuckled.
"I'm afraid I can't tell you my name. I'm not supposed to be here. I'm definitely not supposed to marry you. So if you could just call me husband, that would be great. assuming you're okay with marrying me.
I have a choice?
Look, I'm in love with you. I know that's insane since we've just met, but I've been watching you for a long time. Not in, like, a stalker way. He sighed. Sorry, I'm really messing this up.
Psyche's feelings were hopelessly jumbled. She was used to people watching her. She'd endured that her whole life. You think you're in love with me because I'm beautiful?
No, said the man. Well, yes. Of course you're beautiful, but I love you because of how you've handled it. You've never let it go to your head. You tried to tell the people no. You kept your faith in the gods. I admire the way you endured your sadness and loneliness.
She didn't want to cry, but her eyes stung. Nobody had ever said anything so nice to her before. She was relieved to be in total darkness, where appearances didn't matter. The man touched her fingers. Psyche was surprised to find that his hand felt warm and strong and very human.
I can't even show you what I look like.
He sounded sad.
If you knew my identity, our marriage would fall apart. You'd suffer terribly. It would ruin everything.
Why?
I'm sorry. You'll just have to trust me if you can. I promise you this. I'll be a good husband. Whatever you need, just ask. But the ground rules are non-negotiable. We can only meet here at night in total darkness. Each morning, I'll be gone before the dawn. You can never know my real name. You can never look at me. Don't even try it.
Psyche could feel her own pulse racing as she held his hand.
What if I see you accidentally? What if there's a full moon or something?
Don't worry about that, he said. The darkness is an extra precaution, but I'm also invisible. The only time you could potentially see me is when I'm asleep. While I'm sleeping, I can't will myself to be invisible. But as long as you don't do something silly, like get up in the middle of the night, light a candle, and intentionally look at me, we'll be fine. Psyche, I'm serious, though. You don't want to look at me. It would destroy us.
Us? He said the word like it was a real thing, like they were already a couple.
I don't want to rush you, he said. We can just talk. I know this is awkward.
Kiss me, she said, her heart fluttering. He hesitated.
Are you sure?
You have lips, don't you? You're not like a bird monster or a zombie or something? He laughed under his breath.
No, I have lips.
He kissed her, and Psyche's insides melted into her My Little Pegasus footies. When he finally pulled away, she had to remember how to speak.
That was... wow. That... wow.
Yeah, he agreed. So...
kiss me again, husband.
She could almost feel him smiling.
You're the boss, he said.
The next few weeks were great. Every day, Psyche chilled at the palace, enjoying her gardens and her indoor pool and her bowling alley. Every night, she couldn't wait for her husband to get home. He was the kindest, funniest, most amazing guy she'd never seen. No way was he a monster. She touched his face. It felt like a perfectly normal human face. Handsome, in fact. Very handsome. His arms were smooth and muscular. His... well, you know what? I think that's good enough. I'm doing my best here, but I'm just not used to describing a dude from a lady's point of view. Sorry. Psyche was happily married. Nuff said. The only problem? She missed her family. Why? Good question. Her sisters had always been mean to her, or at best, fake nice. Her mom and dad had always been clueless. They dressed her in a funeral/wedding dress and let her jump off a rock. But family connections are weird. Even if your relatives aren't particularly good to you, they're still your blood. You can't lose that connection completely. And believe me, I've got a few relatives on my dad's side that I would love to lose. Sometimes, when Psyche was sitting quietly in her garden, she thought she heard her family calling her name from far, far away. Once she heard her father's voice, then her mother's. Mostly she heard her sister's, and they sounded distressed, which wasn't like them. This made it hard for Psyche to enjoy her swimming pool or her buffet lunch or the invisible shoulder massages given by her invisible spa attendants. One night, Psyche asked her husband about the voices because she was afraid she was going crazy. In the darkness, he laced his fingers through hers.
"You're not going crazy, my love. Your father and mother haven't been doing well since you disappeared. They are sick with grief. Since your body was never found, they made your sisters promise to look for you. Every day, your sisters travel to that spire of rock where you jumped into the wind. They've been calling your name."
Psyche's heart turned into a lump of granite. She'd been so focused on herself, she hadn't considered how her family must be feeling.
"I have to go home," she said. "I have to see my parents."
"You can't," said her husband. "If you leave this valley, you can never come back."
"Why? Can't Zephyrus just..."
"It's not that simple."
Her husband's voice was full of pain, maybe even a little fear.
"Psyche, I'm trying to protect you. You're under a death sentence from the gods. Well, one goddess in particular..."
Psyche had almost forgotten her troubles from being super gorgeous.
"You mean Aphro..."
"Don't say her name," her husband warned. "It's too easy to attract her attention. If you show yourself in the mortal world, all the adoration will start up again. The people will proclaim you a goddess. We'll both be in serious trouble. Everything we have here, our private world, will be compromised. Please, just let your family believe you're dead."
Psyche had never felt so torn. She was happy for the first time in her life. Despite the weird restrictions on their relationship, she had quickly grown to love her husband. She didn't want to mess that up. Plus, the buffet line was pretty sweet. On the other hand, her parents were sick from grief. Her sisters were searching for her daily, crying out her name. Psyche wasn't a selfish person. She didn't like turning her back on people. She couldn't enjoy her happiness knowing that others were miserable.
"What about a compromise?" she asked. "I won't leave, but let my sisters come here."
"Psyche."
"I'll make them swear to secrecy. They'll only stay long enough to see that I'm alive and well. They'll just tell my parents so they can stop worrying. That's it."
"This is a very bad idea," her husband said. "Your sisters have always been jealous of you. If you bring them into our home, they will poison your thoughts. If you love me, please listen to me. This will ruin everything."
She kissed his hand. "You know I love you. I promise I'll be careful. But you did say I should ask for whatever I needed. I need this." Reluctantly, her husband agreed. The next morning, Psyche walked to the field of wildflowers where she'd first landed. In the distance, she heard her sisters calling her name.
"Zephyrus," she said, "bring them here, please."
Immediately, her sisters came plummeting out of the sky, screaming and flailing their arms. They landed face first in the wildflowers. I guess Zephyrus didn't think much of them, or maybe they were flying in economy class.
"Sisters," Psyche said, so glad to see you. Let me help you up."
Ever had one of those urges to do something like, "Oh my God, this is the best idea ever," and as soon as you do it, you're like, "What was I thinking?" Psyche felt that way as soon as she saw her siblings. Suddenly, she remembered how mean they could be. She started regretting her choice to bring them there. But it was too late now, so she tried to make the best of it. Psyche gave them a tour of the palace. She explained how the wind had carried her there to meet her new husband. She apologized for not calling or writing, but there was this whole death sentence from the gods thing, and it was vitally important that the mortal world believe she was dead. At first, the sisters were too stunned to say much. Over the course of the next few hours, they went from mystified to slightly relieved about their sister being alive to secretly outraged about how cool her new crib was. Psyche showed them the bowling alley, the indoor pool, the buffet, the endless bedrooms and gardens and living rooms and home theater rooms with popcorn machines.
What's in here?
The eldest sister pulled open a closet door and was nearly crushed under an avalanche of gold bars, diamonds, rubies, and bow ties.
Oh, that's just storage, Psyche said sheepishly.
The middle sister stared at the treasure, which was worth more than her husband's entire kingdom.
You have many storage closets like this? I haven't counted. A few dozen? But that's not important.
She offered each sister a private suite to freshen up in before lunch. The invisible servants treated them to hot baths and massages, haircuts and pedicures. They got new outfits that were 50 times more stylish than their old ones, and jewelry worth more than their father's entire treasury. Then they had peanut butter and jelly sandwiches on the veranda because Psyche was all about PB&J.
Who is your husband? The eldest sister demanded. How can he afford all this?
He's a merchant. Psyche felt bad about lying, but she'd promised her husband not to give away too many details, especially not the fact that he was invisible and only visited during total darkness. He was afraid that might freak out her sisters, though I can't imagine why.
A merchant, her middle sister repeated. A merchant who controls the wind and has invisible servants.
Well, he's very successful, Psyche mumbled.
Can we meet him? Asked the eldest sister. He's away, on business.
Psyche stood abruptly.
Well, it's been wonderful seeing you. I really have to get back to stuff.
She loaded her sisters up with expensive presents and escorted them back to the edge of the valley.
But Psyche, said the middle sister, at least let us visit you again. We'll bring you news from home, and we miss you, don't we, sister?
The eldest sister nodded, trying not to dig her fingernails into her palms.
Oh, so much. Please let us visit again.
I'm not sure, Psyche said. I promised my husband he wouldn't forbid a visit from your loving family. The middle sister laughed.
He's not a monster, is he?
Well, no.
Good, said the eldest sister. Then we'll see you same time next week.
Zephyrus carried the sisters away, but Psyche felt like she was the one trapped in a tornado. That night, she told her husband about the visit. When he heard that the sisters wanted to visit again, he did not yell hooray and dance around the room.
I warned you they would toy with your emotions, he said. Don't have them back. Don't let them wreck our happiness. Besides,
he placed his hand gently on her belly.
You have the baby to think about.
Psyche's heart did a double flip.
I'm going to...
Yup.
Are you sure?
Yup.
How?
I just know. Please, no more family visits. Forget your sisters.
Psyche wished she could, but if she was having a baby, she should at least tell her family, shouldn't she? Also, her sister's question kept replaying in her head.
He's not a monster, is he?
I'm committed now, Psyche said. I promise I won't let my sisters ruin our happiness. Just let them visit one more time. Her husband took his hand from her belly.
I won't stop you.
His voice sounded heavy with regret. Afterward, for the first time, Psyche had trouble falling asleep in her comfortable new bed. That same night, as soon as the west wind returned Psyche's sisters to the rock spire, they started to whine to each other.
Oh my gods, shrieked the middle sister. Did you see that mansion? Did you see the gardens? Demanded the eldest sister. The bowling alley? The walk-in closets? What the Hades? I had to marry an old king with no hair and bad breath, and his house isn't half that nice.
Stop complaining, said the middle sister.
My husband has back trouble and terrible personal hygiene. He's repulsive. He certainly doesn't provide me with jewelry and invisible servants. And that popcorn machine? Oh, gods, the popcorn machine.
Both sisters sighed. You could almost see the green auras of envy glowing around their heads.
We can't leave our sister in that place, said the eldest. It's obviously some sort of trick or enchantment. Her husband probably is a monster.
Totally a monster, the middle sister said. We have to find out the truth for her own good.
For her own good, the eldest sister agreed. Gods, I hate her so much right now. I know, right?
They went back to their parents' palace because the sisters were in the mood to be spiteful. Instead of telling their mom and dad the truth, they reported that Psyche was dead.
We saw the corpse, the middle sister said. There wasn't much left, but it was definitely her. It was disgusting.
Disgusting, the eldest sister echoed. We buried her. Really gross.
This news broke their parents' hearts. Within 3 nights, the king and queen were both dead. The sisters wept, but not too hard. Now they would get to divide the kingdom between the two of them. Besides, it served their parents right for letting their brat baby sister Psyche get all the attention and the best marriage. Yeah, those sisters, they were keepers. At the end of the week, they once again traveled to the rock spire. The west wind picked them up and carried them to Psyche's secret palace of popcorn and diamonds. He didn't dump them face first in the grass this time because Psyche had made him promise not to, but he got passive-aggressive revenge by not giving them a proper safety briefing. Anyway, when they sat down to lunch with Psyche, the sisters were prepared.
So, said the eldest, how's that great husband of yours?
Oh, he's great, said Psyche.
The middle sister smiled encouragingly.
What did you say he does for a living?
Psyche blanked. She'd never been a good liar, and now she couldn't remember what she'd told her sisters.
Well, he's a shepherd.
A shepherd?
Yes, Psyche said meekly. A rich shepherd.
Her eldest sister leaned forward and took her hands. She put on her best "I care so much about you" look, even though she wanted to strangle the lucky, undeserving, infuriatingly gorgeous girl.
Psyche, what are you not telling us? Last week you said your husband was a merchant. Now he's a shepherd. We're your sisters. Let us help you.
But everything's fine.
The two sisters exchanged a knowing glance.
That's what people usually say when everything is not fine, said the middle sister. Psyche, we think you're in danger. You haven't forgotten about the prophecy from the Oracle of Delphi, have you? You were doomed to marry a monster, a beast that terrifies even the gods. Prophecies always come true. Dad was constantly worrying about that. He talked about it nonstop, right up until he died.
Psyche choked on her lemonade.
Wait, Dad is dead?
Yes, he died of sadness because you wouldn't come visit him. But that's not important right now. You have to tell us who is your husband, really.
Psyche felt like someone was burying her up to her neck in sand. Her father was dead. Her sisters were trying to help her. Prophecies were never wrong. But her husband's kind voice, his gentleness.
I don't know who he is, Psyche admitted. I'm not allowed to look at him.
What?
The middle sister said.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Back up and tell us everything.
Psyche shouldn't have, but she confessed about her husband's invisibility, his nighttime visits, his refusal to tell her his name. She told them about her unborn child. The My Little Pegasus pajamas with the footies, everything.
It's worse than I thought, said the eldest sister. You see what's happening, don't you?
No,
Psyche said.
Your husband is a dragon, said the eldest sister. Dragons can take human form. They can turn invisible and do all sorts of sorcery. I bet he's only kept you alive to fatten you up once your belly is nice and big. Sister, Psyche protested. That's impossible. Also sick. But she's right, said the middle sister. That happens all the time with dragons. It does? Said Psyche. The eldest sister nodded gravely. You have to save yourself. Tonight, when your husband is asleep, light a lamp or something. Check out his true form. I hope I'm wrong. Really, I do. But I'm not. Be sure you keep some sort of knife or razor handy. When you see his horrible, monstrous face, you have to be quick. Cut off his head. Then call us back to the valley, and we'll help you get out of here. We'll divide up all this lovely treasure, the middle sister said. Although that's not important, the eldest sister said. Not important at all, the middle sister agreed. We only care about your safety and happiness, Psyche. We'll take you back home and find you a proper mortal husband, like ours. Yes, the eldest sister agreed, thinking a much older, smellier husband. I don't know, Psyche said. I can't. Just consider what we've said, the eldest sister urged. And for the gods' sake, be careful. Having thus advised Psyche to destroy her life very carefully, the sisters returned to the mortal world via Zephyrus Airways. That night, Psyche made herself ready to do the stupidest thing in the history of ever. In one of the bathroom cabinets, she found a straight razor, one of those old-fashioned Sweeney Todd-looking things that would make a great weapon if you were, say, attacked by a giant feral pig. Not that I would know anything about that. She hid the razor in her nightstand drawer, along with an olive oil lamp and a box of matches, or whatever they used to light stuff back then. Heck, I don't know. As usual, her husband arrived after dark. All the lights went out, and he sat on the bed, and they talked for a while. How was your day? Oh, fine, my sisters didn't say anything that made me homicidally paranoid.